This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. As headlines focus on Iran's nuclear program and diplomatic efforts to stop it, Hans Blix is taking the longer view on weapons of mass destruction. As you probably remember, during the lead-up to the invasion of Iraq, Blix was the head of the UN Weapons Inspection Team in Iraq. Before that, he spent 18 years as the director of the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA. After the invasion of Iraq, Blix left the UN and was asked by the Swedish foreign minister to head a new independent international commission to examine how the world could tackle the problem of weapons of mass destruction. The Weapons of Mass Destruction Commission's work is largely financed by the Swedish government. Blix presented the commission's new report to the UN today. It proposes ways to reduce WMD around the world and eventually outlaw all WMD. I spoke with Blix yesterday. I said to him, you could argue that writing proposals is simple, but getting countries to comply and give up their weapons is very difficult.
It's often said that nothing is so strong as an idea whose time has come. And if you come with a message and you come with some proposals at a moment when there is no receptivity for it, well, then you don't get very far. I was at the IAEA when the Chernobyl accident occurred in 1986, and that was the moment when we certainly could do a great deal to improve nuclear safety through conventions and other means. And I was there also in 1991 when we discovered how the Iraqis had been hiding their programs of weapons of mass destruction, and thereafter it would prove possible to strengthen the whole safeguard system, the verification system, inspection system of the IAEA. Before that, it would not have been possible. Now, we are in a similar situation. We are coming out with a number of messages here. And what is the world, what is the receptivity for it today? And I have some hope for that. I think that with the Iraq war, Saddam Hussein was ousted, and that's a great benefit of the war. Although I think if he had stayed, if the war hadn't occurred, he would probably have faded a bit like Castro or Gaddafi. But anyway, that was a gain. But what we also experienced is, first of all, that a big war was fought to eliminate weapons of mass destruction. They didn't exist in the first place. In the second place, that the military approach to doing away with weapons of mass destruction was very, very costly. So today, maybe the question is there, should one not use other means, less bloody, less expensive means, to try to avoid a proliferation and the threat of weapons of mass destruction? I think that's what we are witnessing now in the case of North Korea and in the case of Iran.
Let me quote something from your report. You write, so long as any state has weapons of mass destruction, especially nuclear weapons, others will want them. So long as any such weapons remain in any state arsenal, there's a high risk that they will one day be used by design or accident. What are you saying about countries like the United States that have quite a large arsenal of nuclear weapons? What do you think this country should be doing?
We are telling Iran that don't go on with enrichment of uranium. We're telling the North Koreans that they should do away with the nuclear weapons they claim they have. But at the same time, we see discussions about the acquisition of bunker busters, new types of nuclear weapons in the U.S. And in the U.K., they are beginning to discuss whether they should have the Trident program replaced by a more modern program. The French will be in front of the same question. And surely the Russians, the Chinese are also discussing new weapons. But it is difficult to come out and tell others, stay away from these things, which we are refining and developing.
One of the things that your report recommends is that countries that do have nuclear weapons sign no first use pledges. What would a pledge like that read like? And would you like to see the United States sign a pledge like that?
Right. Well, that is a proposal that has been on the table for a long time. I mean, not all our proposals are brand new. We are not so presumptuous as to think that we can come with new proposals for everything. And the non-first use idea is one that has been around for a long time. But it has a special actuality now, and that is that we hear that U.S., for instance, is saying that they might use nuclear weapons in retaliation for, or perhaps even preemption of, a use of by other weapons of mass destruction, biological or chemical weapons of mass destruction. We've heard President Chirac also saying that if there was a risk of a country assisting terrorists in the use of some weapons of mass destruction, it would be an open question what France would use in return. Now, that would mean that if someone were to use gas somewhere or a biological attack, that the other state could use nuclear weapons in retaliation. That would be a first use of nuclear weapons, which now seems to be open to them, and which we think would be very risky, because then it might develop into a duel of nuclear weapons used by other states as well. So we would like them to affirm that no first use in any circumstance.
Let's take a look at Iran. What kind of mix of carrots and sticks do you think should be offered to Iran now?
I think that waving of sticks is often counterproductive, because many states will say that, sorry, but we will not negotiate under a threat. If you remove the threat, then we can talk about it. And they will know what the sticks are and the threats are anyway. The first carrot, you might say, is that if they should refrain from making their fuel, enriched uranium for fuel, then you must assure their supply. They have two units of nuclear power plants, and they will need fuel. So they must be assured that they can get fuel from abroad if they stay away from producing it themselves. I think that the question of assurance of supply in the case of Iran of fuel for their nuclear power industry is manageable. And we have recently heard how the Western European states have said that they might even offer Iran to be sold light water reactors. I think that's a very good suggestion, a good carrot, because it demonstrates that the Western world is not against Iran coming and going for modern technology. The Iranians have often said that the Western world wants to stop us to go into the nuclear age. But this proposal, I think, is a carrot that is very effective, maybe helpful in the first place, and shows that they don't want to stop the Iranians. Another feature which is important relates to security. With seeing so many U.S. soldiers, over 100,000 soldiers in Iraq and American bases in Pakistan and Afghanistan, and seeing U.S. activities also in the former Russian Soviet republics to the north, I don't think one should be surprised if they are concerned about this kind of encirclement. And therefore the question of security and possible security guarantees have come up.
I think a lot of people are wondering, is what we are seeing now in terms of negotiations about Iran going to lead to what happened when we were negotiating about Iraq? I mean, we ended up invading Iraq. Is that going to happen with Iran? And I'm wondering, I know you can't predict this with certainty, but you're certainly as informed as anyone. What do you think? Do you think that that the United States might lead an invasion of Iran? Or use military force, bomb Iran?
The commission, whose report I'm here to present, does not pronounce itself on this, but suggests what one should do, including the question of security and assurance of supply, etc. But I understand your question. I mean, if the Iranians were simply to shrug it off or defy the Security Council, it might say that we have then to escalate into something new, and if then the Russians and the Chinese were to come and vote negatively with a veto in the Security Council, then theoretically the U.S. might say, well, the Council again is not fulfilling its duty, so we will have to do something separately. However, my impression is, reading what Washington is saying, that they really have no intention to go for military force in Iran, and judging also by what I see from U.S. public opinion, I think that's highly unlikely. I think the other way of both of providing incentives for them to and assurances that is more hopeful. But I come back to the need for disarmament measures. You see, simply tell the Iran that you must behave yourself, or to tell them that you are troublemakers, I don't think that will lead us where we want to.
What's at stake in Iran? If Iran actually does develop a nuclear weapon, what would that mean?
Well, I think it changes the strategic balance in the Middle East. The Israelis will certainly feel exposed, especially after the the warnings or the rhetoric of the Iranian president that he'd like to wipe Israel out of the map of the earth. But I must remember also that Iran is not Iraq. When the Iranian president had said this, he was criticized in the Iranian parliament for it. If someone had criticized Saddam Hussein in Iraq, he wouldn't have been alive very many minutes after it. So there may be a question whether this is horrible rhetoric or whether it is something more serious. But certainly is that the Israeli superiority and their possession of a couple of hundred nuclear weapons, if that were matched by some nuclear weapons on the Iranian side, it would change the picture very much and would be much, much more dangerous. And therefore, I think it would be desirable that they stay away from this. It would be desirable that the whole world, including Israel, will try to do things that would convince the Iranians that it is not necessary that we are walking towards peace and not towards an increased tension.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Hans Blix, and he's now the chair of the Weapons of Mass Destruction Commission. And their goal is to propose ways for reducing weapons of mass destruction around the world. They've issued a new report called Weapons of Terror, Freeing the World of Nuclear, Biological, and Chemical Weapons. You've just completed the Weapons of Mass Destruction Commission's report, Weapons on Terror. What are some of the proposals you're making in that report for dealing with terrorists' access to weapons of mass destruction? What are some of the ways you're proposing to prevent terrorists from getting biological, chemical, or nuclear weapons?
Well, one of the most important ways is to prevent that they can lay their hands on equipment or indeed on weapons themselves. So putting locks on the weapon stores is a good start. And there's a lot of that being done in Russia, and lots of Western money and lots of U.S. money that has gone into improving the locks and the control. Because during the Soviets' time, well, then you had a sort of police state that was everywhere. And when the police state disappeared, more or less, then they need to have better legislation and better technical means of protection. So this is one means. You also have conventions which are there for the protection of nuclear material. You need to have good accountants, for instance, of nuclear material. And sometimes talk is about the so-called dirty bombs. A dirty bomb is not a nuclear weapon that would explode, but it's a weapon that contains radioactive material like cobalt or cesium or other stuff, and you put some conventional explosives together with it, and then you explode it in a public place in London or New York or Paris, and it brings a lot of radiation. It will contaminate. It will not kill all that many people, but it will certainly bring a lot of panic. And so keeping control over these radioactive materials is an important part.
How does your Weapons of Mass Destruction Commission propose dealing with somebody like A.Q. Khan, who was, you know, like a nuclear freelancer who sold technology and weapons designs to countries and perhaps to individual terrorists? There, you know, A.Q. Khan is not a country. You don't negotiate with him. You know what I mean? He's a freelancer. So how do you propose dealing with people like that?
Well, we support the ideas which have already been acted upon, that states, members of the UN, should have criminal legislation which will be operative against individuals, whether the individuals themselves are trying to make weapons of mass destruction or they're trying to sell them. And the resolution adopted by the Security Council, the resolution 1540, as adopted a couple of years ago, precisely requests and requires member states to take such criminal action.
My understanding is that A.Q. Khan is basically under house arrest in a very nice house, and that he is protected from any kind of questioning from the international community. And in other words, he got off very easy, is my understanding, because the United States wants to maintain a good relationship with Musharraf so that Musharraf will cooperate in the war on terror. But in the meantime, one of the possible real guilty parties is getting off really easy. And I wonder what your reaction to that is.
Well, I think that you must think forward. I don't think that Mr. Khan will be able to do this thing once again. But any reaction or punishment of him, I think, should send a signal to others. But you also have to be aware that in every country you have your own domestic concerns, and I assume that one of the constraints the Pakistani government has felt is that he is also regarded as a national hero because he helped to develop a nuclear weapon that a majority of people in Pakistan perhaps feel that they need to balance the nuclear weapons in India. I don't know the exact movements in or the thoughts, but that's what I imagine is at play.
I've been wondering if the war in Iraq weighs on you in a personal way. You know, what I'm thinking is, you know, your team couldn't find weapons of mass destruction. You wanted more time to keep looking. That time was denied you because of the invasion. Weapons of mass destruction have not been found in Iraq. So, you know, if you were given more time, perhaps there wouldn't have been a war. So do you think of the war in Iraq in a very personal way?
No, not really. I mean, I feel more like an analyst, and I don't feel a grudge. I mean, I regret what happened. I think it was tragic. I think that if the Security Council would have allowed the inspectors to continue with inspections for a few months, we would have been able to report that all the sites we had gone to had no weapons of mass destruction. And since many of these sites were given to us by intelligence organizations, including the CIA, they would have realized that the tips they had, the sources they had, were unsatisfactory. We had told them about 36 of cases which they had given to us, that there was nothing. So they should have realized that in those cases the sources were unsatisfactory. And maybe it would have prevented the war. It would have certainly been more difficult to move towards war. However, that is history, and I think that now it's more important to try to learn from the Iraqi affair. And one lesson that I think must be learned is that the use of international inspection was more objective than the national ones. The national ones turned out to be much more influenced by either wishes or instructions. It says more influenced by wishes of the governments, of Blair in the UK government and of the executives in the US government. They were more susceptible and accepting such pressures, whereas we international inspectors had the orders from the Security Council, and our only instinct was to do a good professional job. We did not say that there were no weapons of mass destruction. We said that we had carried out 700 inspections professionally, and we didn't find any. So, and so some people have accused us and said that you should have said there weren't any weapons. No, we stuck to the truth, and it turned out that this critical professional attitude came closer, much closer to the truth than what the UK and the US and even other countries' intelligence did.
Clearly, you're very worried about the threat of weapons of mass destruction. There are tens of thousands of nuclear weapons that Russia and the United States has now. When you think of that, and when you think of the possibility of accidents, how worried are you?
Well, we should be worried, and I am worried, because you have a great many of these are on hair trigger alert, and they have systems of launch on warning. So there is a risk, as we say, that there could be something launched by accident. Right now, there's a discussion in the U.S. whether they should develop some conventional types of weapons that could be fired with Trident from U.S. submarines. And the risk would be that another country that may mistake and say that, well, Trident, that's usually nuclear weapons. So it might blur the distinction between a conventional and nuclear weapon. That's a risky thing. And all this risk of accident, yes, it is there. And it does worry both me and it should worry everybody else.
One more question. Do you know that you were a character in the animated movie Team America?
I've heard about that, yes.
Have you seen it?
No, I haven't seen it. But I heard it described, and I know that my head was lopped off and then thrown into some pool of sharks or whatever it was. But, you know, my reaction was simply that they made me say that if you do not behave, we will make a report. And that was made to sound ridiculous, that a report has no importance at all. It has no weight at all. I think that's a mistake. If we had reported to the Security Council that, well, we have listened to the CIA, we have listened to the others, and we have no reason at all to doubt that what they say has a lot of evidence, such a report would have carried a lot of weight. We did not. We said that we had carried out 700 inspections and we have found nothing. Now, it didn't sway the US and the UK or Spain, but the majority in the General Assembly, the majority of the Security Council, were impressed by that report. Maybe they wanted to come to that conclusion, I don't doubt that. But at the same time, that report, what we said, carried a weight, and it prevented the Security Council from authorizing a war, which in my view it shouldn't authorize. I think the Council was right in not authorizing the war, and I think it really speaks in favor of the UN, of the wisdom, rather than that it sort of betrayed the US.
Well, Hans Blix, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks very much for good questions.
Hans Blix heads the Weapons of Mass Destruction Commission. To find out more about the commission and its new report, go to our website at freshair.npr.org.